This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hi, this is Gary Clinton. As usual, we have some old radio shows for you, and maybe a little more. The first show tonight is from Michael McCabe's Beyond Midnight from 1969 and 1970. The episode is called Harry, and I don't know exactly when it first aired. Harry is one of those stories about a child's imaginary playmate who turns out to be something rather different than you expect. Or maybe, given the nature of these stories, turns out to be exactly what you did expect. This has been done a lot, I know, but this is a pretty good rendition.
Such ordinary things make me afraid. Sunshine, sharp shadows on grass, white roses, children with red hair, and the name Harry. Harry, such an ordinary name.
Biotex, the new soak and pre-wash powder, presents Beyond Midnight by Michael McCabe.
Yet the first time Christine mentioned it, I felt a premonition of fear. She was 5 years old, due to start school in 3 months' time. It was a hot, beautiful day, and she was playing alone in the garden, as she often did. I saw her lying on her stomach in the grass, picking daisies and making daisy chains with laborious pleasure. The sun burned on her pale red hair and made her skin look very white and lovely. Her big blue eyes were wide with concentration. Suddenly, she looked towards the bush of white roses, which cast its shadow over the grass, and smiled.
Yes, I'm Christine.
She rose and walked slowly towards the bush, her plump little legs defenseless and endearing beneath a too short cotton skirt. She was growing fast.
Yes, my mummy and daddy.
Chris, what are you doing?
Nothing.
Well, come indoors now, darling.
Goodbye, Miss Gilmore. Goodbye.
Chris, who are you talking to?
Harry.
And who's Harry?
Harry.
I couldn't get anything else out of her, so I just gave her some cake and milk and read to her until bedtime. As she listened, she stared out at the garden. Once she smiled and waved. It was a relief, finally, to tuck her up in bed and feel she was safe.
Oh, London, Margaret.
What do you mean, Jim?
Well, it's not so rare for only children to have an imaginary companion. I had one myself called Oz. Used to talk to him all the time. Oh. Some kids talk to their dolls. Chris has never been very keen on dolls. She hasn't any brothers or sisters, so she talks to... what was it? Who did you say?
Harry.
Harry. Well, she hasn't any friends of her own age, so she imagines someone. Harry.
But Jim, why has she picked that particular name?
You know how kids pick things up. I don't know what you're worrying about. Honestly, I don't.
Well, I'm not worrying exactly. It's just that I feel extra responsible for her. More so than if I were her real mother.
Sure, but Chris is all right. Chris is fine. She's a pretty, healthy, intelligent little girl. A credit to you.
And to you.
In fact, a thoroughly nice parent.
Oh, yes. And so modest. Oh, it's silly of me, I know, but... Oh, I just get a bit worried sometimes. I feel better now. You always make me feel better. How do you feel? I felt consoled until the next morning. Again, the sun shone brilliantly on the small, bright lawn and white roses. Christine was sitting on the grass, cross-legged, staring towards the rose bush, smiling.
Hello. I hoped you'd come. Because I like you. How old are you? I'm only 5 and a bit. I'm not a baby. I'm going to school soon, and I'm going to have a new dress. Oh, yes, I did go for a little while. Infant school. But I didn't stay very long because we moved. Daddy had to go somewhere else for his work. And, yes, this time I'm going to start big school properly. And I'll stay there for years and years and years. And I'm going to have a green dress. Do you go to school? Or what do you do then?
I felt myself growing cold as I stood listening to her. Don't be silly, I told myself. Lots of children have an imaginary companion. Just carry on as if nothing were happening. Don't be a fool. But I called Chris in earlier than usual for mid-morning milk.
Can Harry come too?
No!
Goodbye, Harry. I'm sorry you can't come in, but I've got to have my milk. Why can't Harry have some milk?
Who is Harry, darling?
Harry! He's my brother.
But, Chris, you haven't got a brother. Daddy and Mummy have only got one child, one little girl, and that's you. Harry can't be your brother, darling.
Yes, Harry's my brother. He says so.
She drank her milk and emerged with a smeary top lip. And then she grabbed at a plate of biscuits. Well, at least Harry hadn't spoiled her appetite. He's your brother? He says so, does he?
Oh, yes. He's nice. I must have my new dress soon because I want to show him, Mummy. It says green's a nice colour.
Today, Chris... Well, she started speaking to me with a sort of Cockney accent. Just a slight one.
My dearest, every London child gets a slight Cockney accent. It'll be even worse when she gets to school. I mean, the big school, meets all the other kids. Don't worry about...
We don't talk Cockney, Jim. Where does she get it from?
June,
who can she be getting it from?
Butcher, the baker, the milkman, the coalman, the window cleaner. Want any more?
I can't help it. It's just that... Well, darling, everything was so nice, so happy, till this Harry business.
Do you know what I think? I think you should put your mind at rest.
What?
Take Chris along to see old Dr. Webster tomorrow. Let him have a little talk with her.
Jimmy, do you think she's ill in her mind?
Oh, good heavens, no. It's just that you're obviously upset about it. You don't understand, and when we meet something we don't understand, it's as well to take professional advice, that's all. That's what doctors are for. That's what they take a couple of quid from my salary every week for. Go and see Webster.
Yes, I will.
Here, have a cigarette.
Thank you.
Unusual case, Mrs. James, but by no means unique. I've had several cases of children's imaginary friends becoming so real to them that their parents get the jitters. Now, Christine's rather a lonely little girl, isn't she?
Oh, she won't be when she goes to school again, but... Well, I suppose she is at the moment, yes. She doesn't know any other children. We were quite new to the neighborhood.
Yes, you moved, haven't you? Well, I think you'll find these fantasies will disappear when she gets to school and meets the other children. At the moment, this friend of hers is a compensation for real children. You see, every child needs company of her own age. If she doesn't get it, well, she invents it. Older people who are lonely, they talk to themselves, but that doesn't mean that they're crazy or anything. It's just that, they need somebody to talk to.
Yes.
The child is more practical. Seems silly to talk to oneself, says the child, so it invents another, a real person. I don't think you've got anything to worry about.
Oh, that's what my husband says.
Well, I'm sure he does. Still, I'll have a chat with her as you brought her.
Oh, yes.
Leave us alone together, hmm?
Yes. Christine, just come here a minute, will you, darling?
I was waiting.
Where, Chris?
There. See, Mummy, down there by the rose bush. It's just like our rose bush, isn't it? Do you see it?
There's no one there. Now, Dr. Webster wants to see you. Now, you remember him, don't you? He gave you sweets when you were getting better with chicken pox.
Hello, Christine. My, you're growing. Shooting up.
She went into Webster's surgery willingly enough. I waited restlessly. She was talking away to the doctor in a way she never talked to me. You see, I knew then that he would be full of reassurances when they came out. But I was afraid, awfully afraid. And the ridiculous thing was, I couldn't put my fear into words.
Nothing wrong with her whatever. She's just an imaginative little monkey, that's all. A word of advice, Mrs. James. Let her talk about Harry. Let her become accustomed to confiding in you. I gather you've shown some disapproval of this brother of hers, so he doesn't talk much to you about him. Christine? He makes wooden toys, doesn't he, Chris?
Yes, Harry makes wooden toys.
And he can read and write, can't he?
Yes, and swim, and paint, and climb trees. He can do everything.
You see? Sounds quite a wonderful brother to me. He's even got red hair like you, hasn't he?
Harry's got red hair. Redder than mine, too. And he's nearly as tall as Daddy, only thinner. He's as tall as you, Mummy. He's 14.
Don't you worry, Mrs. James. You let her prattle.
Thank you, Doctor.
Goodbye, Chris. Give that up to Harry.
Harry's got red hair. Harry can swim. Harry can light fires. Harry can read and he can write, too. Harry's got red hair. Redder than mine.
Harry is nothing but Harry.
And fish and paint and run farm and make love.
I'm sick of Harry. Oh, but you're looking forward to school, Chris. You know you are.
I won't go without Harry.
He'll feel silly. A great lad of 14 amongst all those little children.
I won't.
It was still daylight, golden shadows and long strips of sunlight in the garden. Then, almost like a dream, the long, thin, clear-cut shadow of a boy near the white roses. Harry! I thought I saw a glimmer of red among the trees, among the roses, like close red curls on a boy's head. Then, there was nothing. The next day, I started on my secret mission. I took a bus to town and went to the big, gaunt building I hadn't visited for over 5 years. Then, Jim and I had gone together. The top floor of this building belonged to the Grey Thorn Adoption Society.
James, how nice to see you again. How's Christine? My goodness, it must be 4 years at least.
Oh, it's more than five, Miss Cleaver.
Well, well.
And Chris is very well. Miss Cleaver, I'd better get straight to the point. I know you don't normally tell people about a child's origins, not even to the child's adopters, but I must know who Christine is.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mrs. James, but I will...
Please, let me tell you the whole story, and you'll see I'm not just suffering from vulgar curiosity.
Yes, all right, then. Steve, won't you sit down? Very queer. Very queer indeed, Mrs. James. Look, I'm going to break our rule for once. I'm going to tell you in confidence where Christine came from.
Thank you.
She was born in a very poor part of London. There were four in the family. Father, mother, son, and Christine herself.
Son?
Yes. The parents hadn't really wanted Christine. Family lived in one room at the top of a very old house, which should have been condemned by the sanitary inspector, in my opinion. It was difficult enough when there were only three of them. But with a baby as well, life became a nightmare. Mother was a neurotic creature. Slatternly, unhappy, too fat. After she had the baby, she took no interest in it. Brother, however, adored the little thing right from the start. He constantly got into trouble for cutting school so that he could look after her. Christine.
Yes?
One morning in the small hours, a woman on the ground floor saw something fall past her window. She heard a thud on the ground outside. She went out to look and found the son of the family there, on the ground. Christine was in his arms. The boy's neck was broken. He was dead. The little girl was blue in the face, but still breathing faintly. The woman worked the household, sent for the police and the doctor, and they went to the top room. They had to break the door down because it was locked and sealed inside. The window was open, but there was an overpowering smell of gas. They found the husband and wife dead in bed. There was a note from the husband. It said, "I can't go on. I am going to kill them all. It's the only way." The police concluded that he'd sealed up the doors and windows, turned on the gas when his family were asleep, and lain down beside his wife until he drifted into unconsciousness and death. That the son must have woken up. Perhaps he struggled with the door, but couldn't open it. He'd been too weak to shout. All he could do was pluck away the seals from the window, open it, and fling himself out, holding his adored little sister tightly in his arms.
So her brother saved her life and died himself?
Yes. He was a very brave little boy.
Perhaps he thought not so much of saving her as keeping her with him. But, dear, that sounds ungenerous. I didn't mean to be Miss Cleaver. What was his name, the brother?
Oh, I'll have to look that up for you. I'm glad Christine is well, though. I'd be most grateful if you'd count this information as a secret between you and me, Mrs. James. As I said, we've never before... The family's name was Jones. The 14-year-old brother was Harold.
I'm sorry you can't come in, but I've got to have my milk. Goodbye, Harry. Goodbye, Harry. Goodbye, Harry.
What does it all mean? I can't understand.
It's not easy. But I think deep in her unconscious mind, Christine has always remembered Harry, the companion of her babyhood. We don't think of children as having much memory, but there must be images of the past tucked away somewhere in their little heads. Christine doesn't invent this Harry. She remembers him so clearly that she almost brought him back to life again.
May I have the address of the house where they lived, please? The house seemed deserted. It was filthy and derelict. But one thing made me stare and stare. There was a tiny garden. A scatter of bright, uneven grass splashed the bald, brown patches of earth. But the little garden had one strange glory that none of the other houses in the poor, sad street possessed. A bush of white roses.
What are you doing here?
Oh, I thought the house was empty.
Should be. Being condemned. They can't get me out. Nowhere else to go. Won't go. The others went quickly enough after it happened. No one else wants to come. They say the place is haunted. So it is, but what's the fuss about? Life and death, they're very close. You get to know that when you're old. Alive or dead, what's the difference?
Yes.
I saw him fall past the window.
What?
That's where he fell, among the roses. Oh, he still comes back. I see him. He won't go away till he gets her.
Who were you talking about?
Harry Jones. Oh, nice boy he was. Red hair, very thin. Too determined, though. Always got his own way. Loved the little girl too much, I thought. Died among the roses. Used to sit down there with her for hours. Then he died there. Or do people die? Nobody's got any answers. No one nowhere.
I hurried across the bright, hot pavement, and my legs felt heavy and half paralyzed. I lost all sense of time. Then I heard the clock strike three, and it chilled my blood. At 3 o'clock, I was supposed to be at the school gate, waiting for Christine. Oh, Christine James. I'm her mother. I'm so sorry I'm late. Where is she?
Christine James? Oh, yes, I remember. She's new, with the little red-haired girl. That's all right, Mrs. James.
Her brother called for her.
How alike they are, aren't they? And so devoted.
The futile search continued for months. The papers were full of the strange disappearance of the red-haired child. The teacher described the brother who had called for her. There were stories circulated about kidnapping, baby snatching, child murders. Then the sensation died down. It became just another unsolved mystery in police files. And only two people knew what happened. An old, crazed woman living in a derelict house. And myself. Such ordinary things make me afraid. Sunshine, sharp shadows on grass, white roses, children with red hair, and the name Harry.
Coming up is one of Arch Obler's plays for Lights Out. This particular one is called Alley Cat. You should listen to these a little more carefully. Arch Obler had such a good ear for dialogue. It's one of the things I notice anyway in these Lights Out plays, how convincingly he captures the voices of the people. You may not be convinced by the plot. In particular, you may not be convinced by this one, in which a woman is turning into a cat. Apparently turning into a cat. I guess the husband could be crazy, but I don't think so.
Lights out, everybody.
Diamond ring. I got that out of mine. I don't know the rest. Girls, cut it. Cut it out. Will you? Linda, for the love of... Cut it out, will you? The old man will be panning here in a minute.
Yeah, so what? Give me my drink, Queenie. Oh, baby, do I feel swell.
Hey, look what time it is. Come on, Queenie. We better blow out of here.
Yeah. No, don't go. Don't go. I don't want to be alone.
What do you mean, alone? Your husband's here, ain't he?
Ah, that guy. What does he know about having fun? Work, work, work. Makes me sicker. I've never been sick before. That's pretty good, huh, Kenny? Come on, stick around. Let's have some more fun. St. Louis woman with all a diamond ring.
For heaven's sake, Linda.
Well, speak of the devil. Hiya, Johnny boy. Come on in. The water's fine. Only it ain't water.
Linda, for heaven's sake, I'm trying to work.
Ah, go away. Go away. You're spoiling my party. Throw him out of here, Kenny. He's only my husband.
Ah, Linda, take it easy.
Get out of here. You, whatever your name is.
Okay.
Well, take that woman with you. Go on, clear out.
No, no, wait. Don't listen to him. It's my house. My house. What, you? You kick them out.
Linda,
my friends.
I beg you.
You kick them out.
With you to keep these people out of this house while I'm trying to get some work done. Haven't you any consideration at all?
You kick them out, my friends.
Yes, and I'll do it again every time I find them here. They're no good, not a one of them. You've promised me time and time again to give them up.
I'll call them back. I'll call them all back. You can't tell me what to do. Not me. They're my friends, mine. I'd give a dozen of you for one of them.
All right, Linda. If that's the way you feel. You haven't got a grain of loyalty in you. All I ask is a little peace and quiet in my own home, and I can't even have that.
Go away.
Night after night, you and these people yowling and screaming like a pack of alley cats, and you the worst of all. I'm through, Linda. I'm through with you for good.
Oh, no, you're not.
Keep away from me. Keep away. Oh, Linda.
Mm-hmm. You see? You're not through with me at all. You'll never be through with me. Never.
Oh, Linda.
Now, let me go. I don't want you, you fool. You're not through with me. I'm through with you.
No.
I'm tired of you. Do you hear me? Tired of you. I'm going to get so far away from that smug face of yours, I couldn't see it with a telescope.
Linda, my wife.
Ha! Your wife. Why do you think I married you?
Oh, you... You love me.
I married you because I was sick of working in a two-bit barbershop, because I was sick of living in a hall bedroom wearing bargain sale dresses. I wanted dough, plenty of it, all I could get. And you were the best chance to get it that came my way.
Oh, no, Linda, you did love me. You must have loved me.
Oh, why, I loved you about as much as that canary up there loves its cage. I told myself I'd stay with you a year, divorce you, stick you for plenty of alimony, and then get out.
We've been married 5 years.
Yeah, 5 years. Because you fooled me, that's why.
I fooled you?
Yeah. You started to make a lot of money. More money than I ever thought you could make. So you're giving me the air.
No, Linda, I love you. I didn't mean what I said. I didn't.
Well, I did.
Linda, don't leave me. You're no good. I know you're no good, but heaven help me, I love you. I'll never love anybody else.
Get out of my way.
No, I won't let you go. You've got to stay.
Get your hands off.
You're no good. You cost me my self-respect, but you stay with me. You stay with me or I'll cut you off without a cent. You'll never get a dime from me, not a dime. Stop it. Stop laughing.
Oh, you sap. You fat-headed sap.
Stop that.
Mm-hmm. So you're gonna cut me off without a cent, are you? Why, you fool. I've got everything that belongs to you now. You hear me? Everything.
What are you talking about?
This house. It's in my name, isn't it? The car. It's in my name, isn't it?
No, you wouldn't.
Oh, wouldn't I? Well, listen to this, my darling husband. I cleaned out the bank account yesterday.
Oh, no.
Every cent of it. I won't be in the street. Oh, no. You will. Now, this is my house. Get your things and get out of here.
I'll kill you.
No,
I'll kill
no,
you.
No, let me go. Let me go. Oh. Touch me again and I'll tear your eyes out.
You cat.
Get out of my way.
That's what you are, a cat. A big, white, heartless cat.
Get out of my
you
way.
You think like one, you screech like one, you claw like one. You even look like one. Your eyes, they're cat's eyes. That's what they are, cat's eyes. A cat, that's what you are. A white cat. I didn't marry a woman, I married a cat.
Keep it up.
Laugh at me.
You're doing
so. Go ahead, laugh at me. You're a cat, a sneaking, yowling cat. A cat. You're a cat. A cat. You're a cat.
Now, that's enough of that. I don't like it.
A cat.
Stop saying it.
A cat, you hear me? A cat.
John. Stop. Staring at me like that. Stop staring at me. John. What's happening to me? John, my head. I can hardly see.
John, help me. John.
Linda.
What are you staring at? What are you staring at? What are you...
Linda. Linda.
Now, John, you've got to control yourself. Everything will be all right.
Oh, Doctor, what have I done? What have I done?
John, please. Please pull yourself together.
I can't.
You are not entirely to blame for what happened.
Oh, I did it. I'm to blame. What'll I do? What'll I do?
Stop talking like that. It's preposterous to say you are to blame. She was in a hysterical condition.
I know, I know.
The suggestion that she was a cat caught her in an unguarded moment and resulted in temporary neurosis.
But she... Doctor, can I go in and see her?
But I tell you, she's sleeping.
I know, but, Doctor, I've got to see her. I've got to look at her. I've got to make sure she's all right. Don't you see? I've got to make sure.
Now, John, please. You've had a hard time of it. You'd better get to bed and get some rest.
No, no. Doctor, listen to me. I've got to see her again. I've got to make sure she's all right. I can't rest until I know.
But I tell you... Oh, very well. Just for the moment.
Yes.
Be very quiet.
Yes.
There. You see? She's resting very nicely.
Doctor, look.
What?
Her hands. Look at her hands. And her teeth. Linda.
No. No, John. You waken her. John.
Linda. Oh, Doctor, listen to her. Listen to her.
Steady, John.
I can't stand it, I tell you. Doctor, what is it? What's happening to her?
I don't know, John. I don't know.
Oh, listen to her. What'll I do? What'll I do?
Fingers into claws. Teeth into fangs. It can't be happening.
But it is.
And yet I've seen it with my own eyes.
You've got to do something, Doctor. You've got to. You're my friend. You've got to help me.
But what? In the name of all that's rational, what?
Well, think. There must be something you can do. A drug. Something. Something.
Oh, John, I don't know what to say. I can't think. I'll call in someone else. Yes, that's it. I'll inform the authorities. They'll take care of everything.
No, no, no. Wait, Doctor, wait.
What's the matter? What is it?
You're going to inform the authorities?
Yes, yes, of course. Don't you see, my boy, it's the simplest way out of this.
Way out?
Of course, for you and for me.
What do you mean?
This horrible thing that's happened to Linda, it goes beyond just you and me. It goes beyond the normal into the supernatural. The world should know about it.
No, no, stop. You mean you're going to let everyone know what's happened to Linda?
Of course I am.
But you can't do that. She's my wife. Do you hear me? My wife.
No, no, now don't get excited again, John. Listen sensibly. We owe it to science.
Science? Who cares about science? She's Linda. She's my wife. And I cursed her to God and I turned her into a yowling beast. It's my shame, mine. And you're not going to tell anyone else about it. No one.
It's my duty, John. I must inform the authorities.
No, no. Keep away from that phone. Keep away, I say.
I'm sorry, John. I must call.
Oh. John. My friend. No, no. Try to sleep, darling. Try to sleep. Yes, yes, I know, darling, but it's almost morning. You must rest. Sleep, Linda, sleep, my darling. All right, darling, I won't cry. I've got to be strong, I've got to help you. And I did help you. He was going to tell them about you, everyone. They'd have taken you away from me, locked you up, pointed at you, laughed at you. But I stopped him, Linda. I stopped him for you. He called me friend. But you're my wife, beloved. And I love you. I pleased you, haven't I, my darling? I never could please you before, could I? But now I've pleased you. I'll tell them he never came here, and no one will ever know, darling. No one but you and I. What is it, darling? What's the matter? Why are you getting up?
What is it? Why go to the window? What do you want out there? Oh, if I could only understand you. If I could only know what you're trying to say to me. Oh, no. Linda. Linda, stop. On my knees, I'm begging you to stop. Linda, beloved, stop.
Yes, yes, I'm coming, I'm coming.
Good morning, Mr. Taylor.
Oh, it's you.
I found this note saying you wanted to talk to me. And Jay, I hope you're not going to quit taking milk from me.
No, I'm not going to stop taking milk. That's what I wanted to see you about. I want milk. More milk, cream, everything.
Well, sure. How much do you want?
4 bottles of milk. No, 6.
6?
Yes, and cream. 6 bottles of cream.
Is something wrong, Mr. Taylor?
Wrong? Why do you think something's wrong?
Well, I only meant...
You meant what? Speak up, you meant what?
Well, don't get sore, Mr. Taylor. I just meant... Well, you don't look so well, and... Well, you know how it is. Sometimes a fella has a couple too many and starts ordering all the milk in the world.
You fool, I'm not drunk. Do you want some of that milk, or do I have to get another milkman?
No, I'll get it for you.
Well, hurry.
6 quarts, 6 cream. Only him and his old lady. The guy's nuts.
Well, good morning, Mr. Taylor. Early again this morning, ain't you?
Morning.
My first customer every morning for the last 3 days. I was saying to my wife this
morning...
Yes,
Mr. Heinrich, some other time. I'm in a hurry. My order, please.
Sure, but you didn't give me an order yet. How about a nice broiling steak?
No, nothing like that.
But broiling
steak... No, stop it. I'm in a hurry, I tell you.
All right. You don't have to get so excited, Mr. Taylor. Now, if you'll tell me what you want, I'll get it for you.
Oh, well, I don't know exactly. A couple of pounds of fresh liver. Yes, that's it, fresh liver.
What? Again?
You heard me?
Oh, sure, I heard you, but look here, for 3 days now, ever since your wife went away, you eat nothing but liver.
Are you going to fill my order?
Sure, I'll fill your order. Nice and fresh, huh? So, 2 pounds, yeah. There we are. Say, you'd think you was raising cats or something.
What? Why do you say that?
Well, you buy liver every day. this morning I caught a couple of mice in a trap. Maybe you'd like to take them along for the cat tour.
Don't say that! Don't say that!
Mr. Taylor, the liver... forgot. Man's crazy. What did I say that was wrong? Cats like to eat mice.
Oh, my Linda. My dearest Linda. Close to me. So close to me. Oh, my darling. It's better this way. You can't leave me now. I'll have you with me always. I'll keep you here. Yes. Just you and I. I won't answer it. They'll go away. All right, I'll answer it. Linda, it can't be anyone that knows. He's dead. I buried him, Linda. You know that. No, stay here, my beloved. They mustn't see you. Be very quiet. Very quiet. Yes, I'm coming. Well, what is it?
Are you the owner of this building?
Yes, what do you want?
Kerrigan's the name. I'm your neighbor. I've got the place across the alley from you.
Oh, my neighbor?
Yeah, Kerrigan's the name. I'm with the department.
Department?
Yeah, I'm desk sergeant at the 3rd District Station.
A policeman?
Yeah, I'm off duty today, so I thought I'd drop over and speak to you. Do you mind if I step in for a moment?
Step in? Oh, no. No, not at all.
Thank you. Well, you got a nice place here.
Yes, yes. Nice, very nice.
You know the same contractors made this place as made mine? You didn't know that, I bet.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, an Irishman by the name of Gil Hooley. He was alive now. Some of the people along here that bought places from him would murder him. What with the trouble they're having.
Oh, trouble?
Yeah, cheap material, plastic cracking, floor sagging, stuff like that.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Now, you take my place. I've had to have a new roof put on and new gutters put in, and I never know what'll go wrong next. Anything wrong around here?
Yeah. Oh, no, nothing at all.
Well, then you're lucky. Say.
What's the matter?
I just remember why I come over. If you don't mind, I'll tell you.
Yes?
Now, it ain't me that's complaining, Mr. Taylor. I'm the kind of a man that can sleep in a boiler factory. But it's my error. Ah, there's a light sleeper for you. I always say that if a star in heaven twinkles too much, the noise wakes up my error.
What's the trouble?
Oh, no trouble at all, Mr. Taylor. Like I'm telling you, I'm the last man in the world to go around having trouble with me neighbors. But you know how the women are. Always finding something to make a fuss about. Oh, say, I'm not disturbing her, am I?
Disturbing?
Yeah, you know, your missus. She's not sleeping in the bedroom there, is she?
No, of course not. There's no one in there.
I thought maybe seeing the daughters go.
No, I tell you, there's no one in there. My wife is out of town.
Ah, well, that's fine. I always like to talk things over man to man without the women around. That's why I made my Ella stay home. Let me handle this, I says. If there's anything wrong, I says, let me do the talking and we'll stay good.
What is it? What's wrong? What do you want to tell me?
Well, to put it plain, it's the cat.
Cat?
Yeah, the cat. You just got it, didn't you?
You heard a cat?
Yeah, it started a few nights ago. No, it ain't disturbed me none, like I says, but my Ella. Well, you see, our bedroom window faces right on the alley, and by golly, she hears every meow that animal makes.
You're wrong.
Huh?
I have no cat.
But my Ella heard... I heard it too, for that matter.
I have no cat.
But I'm telling you, it came from this house.
I tell you, I have no cat. Isn't that sufficient?
Well, now, seeing as you put it so plain, I'll be speaking up plain myself. I'm telling you, I heard a cat yowling last night, and the night before, and the night before that. And as sure as my name's Thomas Kerrigan, it came right from this house. Now, what do you say to that?
Get out.
Now, wait a second, my bucko. Well, get on your high horse.
Get out. Get out of my house.
Well, you sure are making a lot of noise about nothing, young fella. But it's your house, and if that's the kind of a neighbor you want to be, I guess I could...
What are you standing there for? Get out! Get out!
Now, just a minute. Take it easy. No cat, eh? Well, what was that I just heard?
Nothing. Nothing at all. You've got no right to be coming.
You may not be a liar, but you're sure of something close to it. If that ain't a cat in that bedroom there, then I ain't never heard a cat.
Get out! Get out of here!
Oh, no, I won't. Listen to that cat. If that ain't creating a public nuisance, I'd like to know what it is.
It's none of your business. Get out of here. This is my house. Get out of here.
Stop pulling at me, bucko. I may be off duty, but I'm still an officer of the law, and I'm telling you, that cat in there is violating the city ordinance. Now, if you don't make it shut up, disturbing me, Ella, I will.
Stay away from that door. Stay away from that door.
Say, listen to it. There ain't no cat you got in there.
Yes, I lied. It is a cat. It's just a cat. But I'll make it be quiet. But go away, go away.
Now, wait a minute. Take it easy. If it's just a cat, what are you getting so excited about? Just look at
her. No,
look. Look at her. Your eyes blazing. What's going on here? I think I'll have a look.
No, stay away.
No. Get away. Take it away.
I told you to go.
My gun. I'll get my gun. My gun.
Linda. Linda, did you hear him? His gun. Yes. Close to me. Yes, darling, stay close to me. If he comes back, you'll... No. No, they won't hurt you. I won't let them. I did this to you, I did. I cursed to the god. No, they won't hurt you. They won't. Wait there. I've got to find it. They won't hurt you, Linda. No, they can't. I've got it. Now they won't hurt you, Linda. I swear it. They won't ever hurt you. No. No, don't look at my hand. No, why shouldn't you look at it? Yes. There's a gun in my hand. But not to hurt you, darling. It's just to help you. I swear. To help you. Yes. Yes, so close to me. I must do it quickly. Quickly. No. No, don't. Don't try to pull away. No, no, Linda, stay here. I must hold you. I must. You'll be back in a moment. I mustn't miss. Linda, my darling. I heard my beloved. I heard you. Wait for me, my beloved.
Well, does she or doesn't she? Turn into a cat, that is. I'm not really sure. There is the doctor at the beginning of the show who, although says nothing over it, certainly sees something strange going on and leads me to think that the husband isn't just crazy, unless he actually is turning into a cat. We're going to turn from an old radio drama to another one of the LibriVox productions. Some people say LibriVox. I'm not really sure. So I'm going to yield the floor for the next 17 minutes and 22 seconds to Smokestack Jones.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. That's LibriVox.org. Recorded by me, Glenn Hallstrom, also known as Smokestack Jones. SmokestackJones@gmail.com. You'll also find my blog at TooMuchJohnson.blogspot.com. The Doom That Came to Sarnath by H.P. Lovecraft. There is in the land of Minara a vast still lake that is fed by no stream and out of which no stream flows. 10,000 years ago, there stood by its shore the mighty city of Sarnath, but Sarnath stands there no more. It is told that in the immemorial years when the world was young, before ever the men of Sarnath came to the land of Minar, another city stood beside the lake, the gray stone city of Ib, which was old as the lake itself, and peopled with beings not pleasing to behold. Very odd and ugly were these beings, as indeed are most beings of a world yet inchoate and rudely fashioned. It is written on the brick cylinders of Kedatheron that the beings of Ib were in hue as green as the lake and the mists that rise above it. They had bulging eyes, pouting, flabby lips, and curious ears, and were without voice. It is also written that they descended one night from the moon in a mist, they and the vast still lake and gray stone city Ib. However this may be, it is certain that they worshipped a sea-green stone idol, chiseled in the likeness of Bokrug, the great water lizard, before which they danced horribly when the moon was gibbous. And it is written in the papyrus of Ilarnik that they one day discovered fire, and thereafter kindled flames on many ceremonial occasions. But not much is written of these beings, because they lived in very ancient times, and man is young and knows little of the very ancient living things. After many eons, men came to the land of Minar, dark shepherd folk, with their fleecy flocks, who built Thra, Ilarnik, and Kedatheron on the winding river Eye. And certain tribes, more hardy than the rest, pushed to the border of the lake and built Sarnath, at a point where precious metals were found in the earth. Not far from the great city of Ib did the wandering tribes lay the first stones of Sarnath, and at the beings of Ib they marveled greatly. But with their marveling was mixed hate, for they thought it not meet that beings of such aspect should walk about the world of men at dusk. Nor did they like the strange sculptures upon the gray monoliths of Ib, for why these sculptures lingered so late in the world, even until the coming of men, none can tell, unless it was because the land of Minar is very still, and remote from most other lands, both of waking and of dream. As the men of Sarnath beheld more of the beings of Ib, their hate grew, and it was not less because they found the beings weak and soft as jelly to the touch of stones and arrows. So one day the young warriors, the slingers, and the spearmen, and the bowmen marched against Ib and slew all inhabitants thereof, pushing the queer bodies into the lake with long spears because they did not wish to touch them. And because they did not like the gray sculptured monoliths of Ib, they cast these also into the lake, wondering from the greatness of the labor, however the stones were brought from afar, as they must have been, since there is not like them in the land of Minar or in the lands adjacent. Thus of the very ancient city of Ib was nothing spared, save the sea-green stone idol chiseled in the likeness of Bokrug the water lizard. This the young warriors took back with them as a symbol of conquest over the old gods and beings of the, and as the sign of leadership in Minar. But on the night after it was set up in the temple, a terrible thing must have happened, for weird lights were seen over the lake, and in the morning the people found the idol gone, and the high priest Tarnish lying dead, as from some fear unspeakable. And before he died, Tarnish had scrawled upon the altar of chrysolite, with coarse shaky strokes, the sign of doom. After Tarnish, there were many high priests in Sarnath, but never was the sea-green stone idol found. And many centuries came and went, wherein Sarnath prospered exceedingly, so that only priests and old women remembered what Tarnish had scrawled upon the altar of chrysolite. Betwixt Sarnath and the city of Alarnac arose a caravan route, and the precious metals from the earth were exchanged for other metals, and rare cloths and jewels and books and tools for artificers, and all things of luxury that are known to people who dwell along the winding river Ai and beyond. So Sarnath waxed mighty and learned and beautiful, and set forth conquering armies to subdue the neighboring cities, and in time there sate upon the throne in Sarnath the kings of all the land of Minar and of many lands adjacent. The wonder of the world and the pride of all mankind was Sarnath the Magnificent. Of polished desert quarry and marble were its walls, in height 300 cubits and in breadth 75, so that chariots might pass each other as men drove them along the top. For full 500 stadia they did run, being open not only on the side towards the lake, where a sea-green stone wall kept back the waves that rose oddly once a year at the festival of the destroying of Ib. In Sarnath were 50 streets from the lake to the gates of the caravans, and 50 more intersecting them. With onyx they were paved, save those whereon the horses and camels and elephants trod, which were paved with granite. And the gates of Sarnath were as many as the landward ends of the streets, each of bronze, and flanked by the figures of lions and elephants, carven from some stone no longer among men. The houses of Sarnath were glazed brick and chalcedony, each having its walled garden and crystal lakelet. With strange art they were builded, for no other city had houses like them. And travelers from Thra, and Alarnac, and Cathedron marveled at the shining domes whereon they were surmounted. But more marvelous still were the palaces and the temples and the gardens made by Zakhar, the olden king. There were many palaces, the last of which were mightier than any in Thra, or Alarnac, or Cathedron. So high were they that one within might sometimes fancy himself beneath only the sky. Yet when lighted with torches dipped in the oil of Dothar, their walls showed vast paintings of kings and armies, of a splendor at once inspiring and stupefying to the beholder. Many were the pillars of the palaces, all of tinted marble, and carven into designs of surpassing beauty. And in most of the palaces, the floors were mosaics of beryl and lapis lazuli and sardonyx and carbuncle and other choice materials so disposed that the beholder might fancy himself walking over beds of the rarest flowers. And there were likewise fountains which cast scented waters about in pleasing jets arranged with cunning art. Outshining all others was the palace of the kings of Minar and of the lands adjacent. On a pair of golden crouching lions rested the throne, many steps above the gleaming floor. And it was wrought of one piece of ivory, though no man lives who knows whence so vast a piece could have come. In that palace there were so many galleries, and many amphitheaters where lions and men and elephants battled at the pleasure of the kings. Sometimes the amphitheaters were flooded with water conveyed from the lake in mighty aqueducts, and then were enacted stirring sea fights or combats betwixt swimmers and deadly marine beings. Lofty and amazing were the 17 tower-like temples of Sarnath, fashioned of a bright multicolored stone not known elsewhere. A full 1,000 cubits high stood the greatest among them, wherein the high priest dwelt with a magnificence scarce less than that of the kings. On the ground were halls as vast and splendid as those of the palaces, where gathered throngs in worship of Zokalar and Tamash and Laban, the chief gods of Sarnath, whose incense-enveloped shrines were as the thrones of monarchs. Not like the ikens of other gods were those of Zokalar and Tamash and Laban, for so close to life were they that one might swear the graceful bearded gods themselves sate on the ivory thrones. And up unending steps of Zircon was the tower chamber, where from the high priest looked out over the city and the plains and the lake by day, and at the cryptic moon and significant stars and planets, and the reflections in the lake at night. Here was done the very secret and ancient rite in detestation of Bokrok the water lizard, and here rested the altar of chrysolite, which bore the doom scroll of Tarnish. Wonderful likewise were the gardens made by Zakhar, the olden king. In the center of Sarnath they lay, covering a great space and encircled by a high wall. And they were surmounted by a mighty dome of glass, through which shone the sun and moon and planets when it was clear, and from which hung fulgent images of the sun and the moon and stars and planets when it was not clear. In summer the gardens were cooled with fresh odorous breezes skillfully wafted by fans, and in winter they were heated with concealed fires, so that in those gardens it was always spring. There ran little streams over bright pebbles, dividing meads of green and gardens of many hues, and spanned by a multitude of bridges. Many were the waterfalls in their courses, and many were the hued lakelets into which they expanded. Over the streams and lakelets rode white swans, whilst the music of rare birds chimed in with the melody of the waters. In ordered terraces rose the green banks, adorned here and there with bowers of vines and sweet blossoms, and seats and benches of marble and porphyry. And there were many small shrines and temples where one might rest or pray to small gods. Each year there was celebrated in Sarnath the feast of the destroying of Ib, at which time wine, song, dancing, and merriment of every kind abounded. Great honors were then paid to the shades of those who had annihilated the odd ancient beings, and the memory of those beings and their elder gods was derided by dancers and lutenists crowned with roses from the gardens of Zakhar. And the kings would look out over the lake and curse the bones of the dead that lay beneath it. At first the high priest liked not these festivals, for there had descended amongst them queer tales of how the sea-green Ikion had vanished, and how Tarnish had died from fear and left a warning. And they said that from their high tower they sometimes saw lights beneath the waters of the lake. But as many years passed without calamity, even the priests laughed and cursed and joined in the orgies of the feasters. Indeed, had they not themselves in the high tower often performed the very ancient and secret rite in detestation of Bokrok the water lizard? And 1,000 years of riches and delight passed over Sarnath, wonder of the world. Gorgeous beyond thought was the feast of the 1,000th year of the destroying of Ib. For a decade it had been talked about in the land of Manar, and as it drew nigh, there came to Sarnath on horses and camels and elephants men from Thra, Alarnac, and Cathadaron, and all the cities of Manar and the lands beyond. Before the marble walls on the appointed night were pitched the pavilions of princes and the tents of travelers. Within his banquet hall reclined Nargis Hay, the king, drunken with ancient wine from the faults of conquered Panath, and surrounded by feasting nobles and hurrying slaves. There were eaten many strange delicacies at their feast. Peacocks from the distant hills of Limpan, heels of camels from the Basnik Desert, nuts and spices from the Sedarian groves, and pearls from wave-washed metal dissolved in the vinegar of Thra. Of sauces there were an untold number, prepared by the subtlest cooks in Almanar, and suited to the palate of every feaster. But most prized of all the viands were the great fishes from the lake, each of vast size, and served upon golden platters set with rubies and diamonds. Whilst the king and his nobles feasted within the palace and viewed the crowning dish as it awaited them on golden platters, others feasted elsewhere. In the tower of the great temple the priest held revels, and in pavilions without the walls the princes of neighboring lands made merry. And it was the high priest, Nika, who first saw the shadows that descended from the gibbous moon into the lake, and the damnable green mist that rose from the lake to meet the moon and to shroud in a sinister haze the towers of the domes of fated Sarnath. Thereafter those in the towers and without the walls beheld strange lights on the water, and saw that the gray rock Acurion, which was wont to rear high above it near the shore, was almost submerged. And fear grew vaguely yet swiftly, so that the princes of Ilarnac and of Far Rakol took down and folded their tents and pavilions and departed, though they scarce knew the reason for their departing. Then, close to the hour of midnight, all the bronze gates of Sarnath burst open and emptied forth a frenzied throng that blackened the plain, so that all the visiting princes and travelers fled away in fright, for on the faces of this throng was writ a madness born of horror unendurable, and on the tongues were words so terrible that no hearer paused for proof. Men whose eyes were wild with fear shrieked loud at the sight within the king's banquet hall, where through the windows were seen no longer the forms of Nargisai and his nobles and slaves, but a horde of indescribable green, voiceless things with bulging eyes, pouting, flabby lips, and curious ears, things which danced horribly, bearing in their paws golden platters set with rubies and diamonds, and containing uncouth flames. And the princes and travelers, as they fled from the doomed city of Sarnath on horses and camels and elephants, looked again upon the mist-beginning lake, and saw the great rock Acurion was quite submerged. Through all the land of Manar and the land adjacent spread the tales of those who had fled from Sarnath, and caravans sought that accursed city and its precious metals no more. It was long ere any travelers went thither, and even then only the brave and adventurous young men of yellow hair and blue eyes, who were no kin to the men of Manar. These men indeed went to the lake to view Sarnath, but though they found the vast still lake itself and the gray rock Acurion, which rears high above it near the shore, they beheld not the wonder of the world and pride of all mankind. Where once had risen walls of 300 cubits and towers yet higher, now stretched only the marshy shore, and where once had dwelt 50 million of men, now crawled the detestable water lizard. Not even the mines of precious metal remained. Doom had come to Sarnath. But half buried in the rushes was spied a curious green idol, an exceedingly ancient idol chiseled in the likeness of Bokrog, the great water lizard. That idol, enshrined in the high temple at Ilarnac, was subsequently worshipped beneath the gibbous moon throughout the land of Manar. The end of The Doom That Came to Sarnath by H.P. Lovecraft.
Well, next we're going to get into Dimension X from, I forgot. Let me look this up real quick. July 7th of 1950. This is an adaptation of Ray Bradbury's short story, Mars is Heaven, which was published in 1948. And by the way, in 1970, the Science Fiction Writers Association of America declared it one of the best science fiction stories ever written. I guess it still is.
When the first space rocket lands on Mars, what will we find? Will we be welcomed with open arms, or will the Martians treat us as invaders? Only one thing is certain. Someday a giant metal ship will take off from Earth to travel through the black velocities, the silent gulfs of space, to descend at last into the darkness of the upper Martian atmospheres. And on that day, man will finally know the answers. The day we first land on Mars.
Now hear this. Approaching critical deceleration. Fasten gravity suits. Stand by the land.
Celestic, what do you make of the terrain?
There seems to be a heavy ground, Miss Captain. We won't be able to use our infrared lights.
We'll have to come in on radar.
Isn't that a little risky, sir, landing in the dark?
I'd rather run the danger of a blind landing, Lieutenant, than come in without the cover of darkness. Remember, we don't know what kind of reception is waiting for us down there.
Airspeed 500. Altitude now 4,000.
Bridge to engine room. Stand by for deceleration.
Engine room, aye.
Fire forward tubes 1 and 3.
Aye.
Kids down.
Kids, check. Altitude 500. 4, 350, 3.
Half a point now. All right. Let's set her down. Look out! Cut the power. Master's pipe battle station.
Aye, sir.
I'll secure it, sir. Well, we're on Mars. April 20th, 1987. 4:33, Greenwich time. Enter that in the log, Master.
Aye, sir.
Well, gentlemen, it's less than 2 hours till dawn. As soon as it's light, we'll send out a landing party. Masters, get me an all-over hookup.
All set, Captain.
Now hear this. All right, men. The smoking lamp is lit. We're 17 men on an alien world. It's up to us whether we ever get home again. Next few hours should tell the story, and I want instant obedience to all commands. I'll court-martial the first man who doesn't jump to when he's ordered. And one other thing. We may be on Mars, but this is still a United States naval vessel. Officers will conduct a personal and weapons inspection in 1 hour. That's all.
Inspection, Captain, now?
Mr. Lustig, we've got an hour and a half to sweat out before we find out what's outside that airlock. I'd rather have a man worried about his stripes, about what's waiting outside, on Mars.
Now hear this. Landing party report to forward airlock. Captain Black, Lieutenant Hingston, Lieutenant Lustig, and Dr. Horst report immediately to forward airlock. It is now landing time, minus 5.
Hey, Mr. Hingston. You ready, Dr. Horst?
Yes.
Ready as I'll ever be.
Come on. Report to the airlock.
Four minutes to go. Hey, where's the captain?
Who knows? What difference does it make?
Just want to get it over with, that's all. Has anybody got a cigarette?
I think you're smoking too much, Lieutenant Lustig. Are you nervous?
Lay off, will you, Horst?
Wondering what's hidden outside underneath that ground mist? Very unusual planet, Mars.
Why?
It has an atmosphere. Wonderful thing, an atmosphere. Where you find one, you find life.
You mean Martians?
What do you think they'll look like?
Who knows? Intelligent life can take many forms.
You mean they may have green skins and eyes on stalks or something?
A comic book conception is possible. Or they may have developed to a point that is far beyond us. Perhaps they have a science that can produce weapons far more dangerous than our atomic missiles.
You think we may have to fight our way out?
After all, we are invaders.
Now hear this. Landing time minus 2. Landing time.
All right. We heard this. I know what I'd like to find outside that airlock. Good old Illinois. You ever been there, Lustig?
Only Chicago.
Well, you ought to see my hometown. Green lawns, big white houses.
Sounds like my hometown.
My grandmother used to have one of those iron deers on the lawn. Every Halloween, we'd paint another color. One time, we painted it black and white like a Holstein cow.
Where does your family live, Horst?
I have no family. When I was a child, they were gassed to death in the Dachau concentration camp.
That's tough.
Oh, it has its advantages. I have no ties on Earth. Nothing to lose now. I imagine I'm the only one on board who is free to enjoy our present peculiar position.
All right, Lustig. You can button it up now.
Aye, sir.
Well, gentlemen, in 1 minute we'll be the first men to set foot on Mars. Quite an honor, eh?
As long as the medals are not awarded posthumously.
Still uneasy, Dr. Horst?
Captain Black, I've been uneasy ever since I can remember. On Earth and on Mars.
Now, 30 seconds. Give me the intercom phone, Lester. Masters?
Aye, sir.
Battle stations will be manned till we return. If we're not back in 2 hours, I want no rescue party sent out. Blast off and save the ship, you understand?
Aye, sir.
All right, gentlemen. 5 seconds. 4, 3, 2, 1. Lustig, open the outer airlock.
Fresh air.
Let's go. Hold it. It's too dark to move fast.
Quiet, isn't it? Not even a wind.
You can't see anything through this ground.
Quiet. We don't know what's out here. Come on.
What the... Quiet, Captain. I could swear that sounded like a rooster.
You don't hear it anymore.
A very unlikely sound. A rooster crowing on Mars.
Kingston.
Aye, sir.
Set that machine gun 25 yards to the flank. We'll stay here till the ground mist lifts.
Aye, aye, sir.
What do you make of the ground, Horst?
Grass. Plain grass. You can see some large foliage there where the mist stand on.
What the heck is that?
Kingston! Hold your fire, you fool!
What?
Some kind of wild animal. I hit it. I could see the traces, but it's still standing.
Come on, Horst.
Doctor! Doctor, where are you?
Up ahead! Admiring the wild animal.
Careful, Horst. Wait for us.
Don't worry, Captain.
It's an iron deer. A lawn ornament.
That's impossible.
It's hollow. Interesting, isn't it? A whitewashed Victorian iron deer. Sitting on a lawn in the middle of Mars.
I don't understand.
Look around. The mist's lifting.
Captain, look there. A house, a regular old-fashioned house.
On Mars.
Good Lord. I haven't seen carved scrolls and gingerbread like that in years. Look at that port swing. The geraniums.
There. I told you it was a rooster, Captain.
Give me the glasses, Lustig. I want to take a look through that front window. What? There's an upright piano. Some sheet music on it.
Lustig, it's beautiful Ohio.
Beautiful Ohio? That can't be.
Look here, Horace, do you think that civilizations of two planets could be identical?
I don't know. That specific variety of geraniums is only 50 years old on Earth.
Is it logical they should develop in Mars? How about that port swing, that piano, and beautiful Ohio?
No, it's impossible.
Captain Black, this looks like the town I was born in.
Well, it looks like my hometown, too.
I've thought of something, sir. It's the only solution. Maybe we're not the first ship to reach Mars from Earth. That's the only answer.
That's impossible, Lister. If there had been space travel, it couldn't be secret. Do you have any idea what ships cost, what industrial power is needed? There's got to be some logical reason.
Captain, I think perhaps we might find out. The light just went on in that house.
Kingston, cover that door with a machine gun.
Aye, aye, sir.
Come on, Horst. You ring that doorbell. There's got to be a scientific answer to all this.
There's something moving in there.
Stand back, Horst. Give me a clear shot. Maybe a Martian.
Can I help you?
We were looking...
Well, if you're selling anything, it's much too early.
No. Wait a minute. What town is this?
What do you mean? Are your senses taken?
No, we're strangers here. We want to know how this clown got here.
Is this a game?
No, no, it's not a game. We're from Earth.
From where?
From Earth.
You mean out of the ground? Hey, are you sure you're feeling well?
Madam, we came in a flying ship across space. We're from the third planet. This is Mars. Now, do you understand? Mars.
You go away now, you hear? I'll call my husband from upstairs, and he'll chase you now.
But
go on.
This is Mars, isn't it?
This is Green Lake, Wisconsin, in the United States of America. Bounded on the east by the Atlantic and on the west by the Pacific. Now, go away. Goodbye.
Horace, do you suppose it's really possible? I've got to find out more about this.
For the last time now, go away.
Pardon me, madam. What year is this?
Year? Well, 1928, of course. Oh, for goodness sake.
You hear that, Horace? And we know it's 1987. And we know it's Mars. Is it possible we got fouled up, made some tremendous blunder, and circled around and landed back on Earth?
In 1928?
Well, maybe some switch in time or dimension. Could we have shifted somehow and gone backward in time? Horace, it won't hold water. It's not logical. We've checked every mile. We went past the moon and out into space. We're on Mars.
Find out anything, Captain?
No, we're going back to the ship till I figure out some logical explanation for all this. Lustig, out at point.
Aye, sir.
Hingston in the rear. Keep that gun at half load.
Aye, sir.
Horace, there's got to be some cold, logical solution.
Captain.
What?
That house down the street. The white one with the green shutters.
Lustig, what's the matter?
I never thought. Thank God! Thank God!
Lustig, come back here!
He's running for that house.
That crazy fool, after him quick.
Lustig, stop!
Come down off of that porch!
Grandma! Grandma!
Lustig, what the devil are you in your truck?
Grandma and Grandpa, it is you!
Lustig, what's going on here?
Albert, why, it's been so many years.
How you've grown, boy.
Oh, it's so good to see you.
Lieutenant Lustig.
Oh, Captain. Grandma, I want you to meet my friend. This is Captain Black. Captain, I want you to meet my grandfolks.
Howdy. Any friends of Albert's is friends of ours.
How long have you been here, Grandma?
Oh, good many years. Ever since we died.
Ever since you what?
Oh, yes, sir. They've been dead 30 years.
What? You mean to tell me that Mars is heaven?
Oh, nonsense, no. All we know is here we're alive again. And who are we to question God's infinite ways?
Lustig, we're going back to the ship.
But, Captain, I want to talk to my grandfather.
Lieutenant Lustig, I don't like any part of this. You come back with us, I have to club you and carry you.
Yeah, but, sir, then I...
Heaven only knows what they've run up against back at the ship.
Dimension X will continue in just a moment. Well, now let's come back to Earth for a moment. And what's more appropriate than Wheaties and baseball? You'll see what I mean as I introduce Ed Prentice, who has a special treat for you. Carry on, Mr. Prentice.
Folks, I'd like to have you meet a good friend of mine and a prominent member of a fine little organization known as the Chicago White Sox, Mr. Lucius Benjamin Affleck.
Ooh, Ed, don't say it like that. Who ever heard of a ball player named Lucius? What if I went around calling you Paul Edward Prentice? Let's just make it Ed and Luke, huh?
All right, Luke. Say, just how long have you been with the White Sox?
Over 20 years, Ed. Golly, I played in darn near 2,500 games. Then it bat almost 9,000 times. Man, I'm from way back.
Well, Luke, you don't look it. How do you keep up the pace, anyway?
Well, Ed, I sleep good. I eat good. I eat mighty good. Wheaties about four mornings a week. Those little old flakes put a lot of snap, even in an old-timer like me. Must be because they're 100% whole wheat. I sure like Wheaties and milk and fruit.
You know, Luke, that's exactly what I hear from a lot of ball players and plenty of other people, too. No wonder they call Wheaties the breakfast of champions. Well, thanks, Luke Appling and Ed Prentice. You know, folks, you may not be a champion ball player, but Wheaties can help you feel like one. So try them. Wheaties, that is. See how Wheaties at 7 can help at 11.
Look
at that crowd around the ship. Looks like we're being welcomed with a celebration.
Celebration? They've abandoned ship. Every port is open. No guards there. You, masters.
Hiya, Captain. Meet my old dad. Dad, that's Captain Black, and he's not a bad guy for an officer.
Of all the... Kingston! What's it? Bring that man back. Use force if you have to.
Excuse me, sir. There's my Uncle George.
Kingston!
I'll be right back, Captain. Uncle George! Uncle George!
What the devil is going
on, sir? They've all found friends and relatives. They're all here.
He's right, Captain.
I've counted.
The whole crew's out in the crop.
But I gave orders. Definite orders.
You don't understand, Captain.
I understand mutiny. I don't care how many relatives show up. I'll have discipline.
Johnny! Johnny, you old son of a gun.
Edward. Edward. It's you. It can't be.
Of course it is. Johnny, you old son of a gun.
Ed. Edward. Dr. Horst. This is my brother, Edward.
How do you do?
Hello.
It's wonderful to see you, Edward. Look, I've got to get back to my ship.
Hey, I almost forgot. Mom's waiting at home.
Mom?
And Dad, too.
Mom? Dad are alive? Excuse me, Horst. Then you're real, Ed.
Don't I feel real? How's that, huh?
Ed,
we've got lunch for you, Johnny. Mom's making corn fritters.
Corn fritters? Dr. Horst, haven't you found anybody?
No, Captain. I have nobody.
Then you come on home with me, right, Ed?
Sure, you bet.
Horst, you wouldn't believe it, but it's been 35 years since I had Mom's corn fritters. By George, 35 years.
And there's plenty more in the kitchen, so don't hold back, Johnny. You too, Dr. Horst.
Well, Johnny, you're still in the Navy, huh?
That's right, Dad. I'm in command of the ship.
We're an old Navy family, Dr. Horst. All three of our boys in the service.
Ed was the best pilot in the Pacific. What did happen, Ed?
Oh, what's the difference? I'm here now.
Oh, you know, it's almost perfect. All we're missing is your brother, Will. Then the whole family could be together.
Well, it won't be long, Mom. Will's in charge of the XR-54. That's the next rocket coming out to Mars.
Well, little Will. When does he leave, Johnny?
Takeoff scheduled for September, but it depends on what we report. There's no question about that now, eh? Christmas together again. That'll be something, huh?
Yes, sirree. Well, this calls for a celebration. How about a little of the old dandelion wine, eh, Johnny?
Now, Father, don't you go giving Johnny too much wine.
Oh, he's a big boy now, Mother. Well, sir, isn't everything just fine? Just fine.
Well, Dr. Horst, what do you think of my little family,
Very nice.
You know, I can't understand why you didn't find any folks here, Dr. Horst. Just a shame. Everybody else is so happy.
I never remembered my family, Mrs. Black. All I know is they were gassed at Dachau during the Second World War. When I was liberated, I was in a delirium 3 months. I cannot remember anything before then. The psychiatric phenomenon.
That's terrible. Isn't there anything anybody can do?
I don't want to remember.
Oh.
I haven't had a pleasant life. I prefer to be free of emotional entanglements. They interfere with a scientific approach.
I'm sorry, Dr. Horn.
Oh, I'll get it. Hey, that's our ring, long and three shorts. I remember that.
Well, maybe we'd better call it a night. You must be getting tired, Johnny.
I'd better be going back to the ship.
Oh, nonsense. You stay the night. We insist.
Oh, I just couldn't rest thinking of you all alone on that ship.
Oh, I'll be all right. Well, good night.
Wait a minute, Dr. Horst. That phone message was for you.
Me?
Yes, that's right. A message from Anna.
Anna? I don't remember any Anna.
She asked if you were better.
Perhaps she's someone you knew at Dachau.
I know.
She said she's coming over here first thing in the morning. So you'll have to stay over.
Yes,
well,
but
that settles it then. You stay here, Horst. You can bunk with me in my old room.
Oh, but Johnny, we thought you'd like to be with Edward.
So you could talk the way you used to.
Well, we can't put Dr. Horst on the daybed. I think we better share the room tonight. There'll be plenty of time for talking, Ed.
I guess so.
Well, I suppose I better drop back to the ship. You know, Ed, security check.
Why do you have to do that here?
Well, I don't know. There's no good reason, I guess. Well, I suppose we skip it tonight.
Oh,
sure. Good night, everybody.
Oh, it's good to have you home, Johnny.
It's good to be home, Mom. Thinking about what we were expecting. Green-skinned Martians with eyes on stalks. All the time there was only Mom and Dad and Edward waiting. Ah, it's funny what tricks your imagination can play on you. Yeah, I guess Mars is heaven, Horst.
I've been thinking about Martians, too.
Yeah.
Captain, just suppose... Suppose there were Martians, and they saw us land. Suppose they thought of us as invaders. What would be the best weapon they could use against our atom bombs?
I don't see what you're getting at.
They would want to disarm us first. To wipe out all suspicion. To make us feel at home. But suppose this house isn't real. Suppose the people are just images. Stolen from our own memories. By Martians. Created for us by telepathy. Hypnotism.
That's the craziest theory I ever heard.
Maybe that's why there was no one for me. Because in all my life, there is no happy memory. No real love person.
Well, how about that phone call from Anna?
Yes. Anna. I didn't remember who she was, but I do now. I just remembered. When I was freed from Dachau, sick, delirious, I raved about a wonderful, kind nurse named Anna that took care of me.
There you are. It's logical. She's coming to see you tomorrow.
But there was no Anna. I'd be nursed by a man.
What?
Anna was only a dream. And there's only one way they could have learned about her. By reading my subconscious mind.
But that's impossible, Horst.
Why? The whole crew was thinking of home. Suppose the Martians read our minds.
Yes, but there are Martians.
If there are, they have us separated. Each man in a different house. Sleeping. Trusting. No one at the guns.
My pistol downstairs. You think there's something to this, Horst?
It's a perfect trap, Captain. Who would suspect his own mother? His grandparents? How easy. Just a knife in the heart of each sleeping man.
That's impossible, Horst. We've got to get back to the ship.
Listen. The crickets have stopped.
Come on.
We don't know when they change back to me. Whatever they really are.
Where are you going, John?
Ed, well, we wanted to drink of water. That's all, Ed.
You're not thirsty, John. You don't want to drink. You don't want to drink.
His face, it's changing. And his hand, he's a Martian!
Run, Horst! Run!
Get away, John! You can't get away!
It's my Horst!
Can't get away!
Horst, where are you?
This is Captain John Black, the XR-53, calling from Mars. I've locked myself in the ship, but they've crippled it. I can't take off or fire the guns, and they're coming for me now, the Martians. I'm all alone here. All the rest are dead. Hinkston, Lustig, Dr. Horst. Poor Horst, he didn't even reach the door. Listen, listen, they're trying to break through the hull now. Edward and Mom and Dad and all the folks. But they're changing now. Melting and changing back into... They're Martians. Can you understand me? Martians, not men. They made us think that Mars was heaven and we fell into the trap. Can you hear me, Earth? You've got to stop the next rocket. Tell my brother Will. Tell my brother Will not to come. They'll trap him too. They'll kill them all. Hello? Hello? Can you hear me, Earth? This is John Black on Mars. Hello, Earth.
This is John Black on Mars! Tonight, Dimension X has presented and transcribed the Ray Bradbury story, Mars is Heaven, adapted for radio by Ernest Canoy. Featured players were Wendell Holmes as Captain Black and Peter Capell as Dr. Horst. Your narrator, Norman Rose. Music by Albert Berman. Engineer, Bill Chambers. Dimension X is produced by Van Woodward and directed by Edward King. Robert Warren speaking.
Coming up is an episode of The Black Museum. We know a fair amount about it. We know that it was produced in 1951 in London by Harry Towns. We know that Orson Welles narrated them. We know that it had an extensive syndication program all over the world, United States, Luxembourg, South Africa. The particular episode that we're doing tonight, The Faded Tartan Scarf, was the 13th. Don't know exactly when it ran. We know the first show was on January 1st of 1951. As I said, this is credited as being the 13th show, so I guess you could figure it out. But nobody has any real confidence in these numbers. I mean, no real confidence that it is actually the 13th show. It is generally credited with being the 13th show, but no one's exactly sure.
Now, The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles.
Here we are in the Black Museum. Beyond these gray walls, the mighty roar of London never stops. But in here, it's quiet. Come with me under the frieze of death masks, the masks of criminals of bygone days, suspended grimly under the ceiling. Come. To our right and left, rows of murder exhibits, each one carefully labeled. That cut glass scent spray, it's attractive even now. Might even take its place on Madame's dressing table. Till we stop and read the label written under it. Yes, it's been used to spray anesthetic over the faces of helpless women. As a prelude to murder. No sickly aroma now, as we squeeze the bulb. Except for its grim associations, the fragile exhibit is insignificant, easily broken. But it was strong enough to hang the man who used it. There, there's a brass candlestick. Over there, a taper to go with it. Now, here we are. Here's what we're looking for. The faded tartan scarf. As I take it out of the showcase, I ask you to come with me back to the time when this scarf was new, 15 years ago. Walter Pevsky bought it from a stallholder in one of London's famous street markets, Petticoat Lane.
Yes, sir. We'll take one of the scarves, mister.
Right, sir! Finest worsted woven! What's your clan? Campbell's, Cameron's, MacDonald or MacLeod? All genuine tartan today down from the islands.
All right, all right. I've bought it already. You don't need to give me that stuff. I'll take this one.
It's the Stuart! And better than that you cannot do! Not half a nicker! Not five bob! Half a crown and cheap at the price! Thank you very much. Come and get your Scotch chokers from Honest John McKay. If your next wall...
While Honest John continued his honest trade, the Pike went about his own particular business. It was less exhausting than John's, and it was work from a public call box. In professional circles, they called it the hospital trick.
Hello?
Is that Mrs. Peterson speaking?
Yes, who's that?
The London Hospital here, Mrs. Peterson.
Hospital? Why, what's happened?
Oh, there's no need for immediate alarm, but I'm sorry to say that your husband has met with a serious accident.
Oh, Bill? Who knew what happened?
He was knocked down by a bus in the Whitechapel Road about half an hour ago.
A mean, crude trick. But more often than not, it worked. While the stricken woman hurried to the hospital to find the husband, who of course was not hurt at all, the Pike would visit her house. With the coast clear, he'd help himself to whatever he could lay his hands on and get out before the bewildered woman returned. And you notice that the Pike could almost camouflage that accent he had. This gift gave him a confidence which was almost his undoing. One time, when he and some friends were removing the entire contents of a house while the owners were away on holiday.
What about the piano, Pike? Do we take that?
Of course we take everything. Who'd think of moving house and leaving the piano behind, eh?
You'll get as bloopy well as you will. Okay, boys, piano next. Oh, crikey, the phone. Here, what do we do about that? Did it ring, I suppose?
Oh, maybe it's someone seen the van outside and checking up. I'd better answer it.
Yeah, yeah, go easy,
Don't Park. Worry, Ed. I know my job, don't I?
Oh, yeah.
Hello?
Is that Mr. Wilson?
No, I'm awfully sorry. He won't be back until about 7 o'clock. I'm his brother-in-law.
Can I help you? If your sister's there...
Oh, Julie's just gone out for half an hour. Can I take a message?
Yes, I think you can. I'm her brother. Who the blazes are you?
Quick, boys. Let's get out of here.
Right out.
So the piano was left behind after all. But Pike got away with most of the household belongings and observed, not only were his operations becoming bolder, but he had planned his action carefully. He even knew that Mrs. Wilson's first name was Julie. But he didn't know she had a brother. That must have shaken him, because from then on he changed his tactics. The Pike entered the motor racket, a racket which was to take him in turn from Dartmoor prison to the scaffold. But in his early days as a motor thief, there was still a trace of strange humor about his work. The padlocked car was a case in point.
Who's that?
Okay, Eddie, it's only me. You wouldn't go reaching for a gun when Parky walks in on you.
I'm sorry, Pike, it's me nerves.
Well, relax. Now, listen to me, I've got a job for you.
Nah, I'm laying off for a bit.
Okay, well, who pays the rent?
Oh, I'm only going in for the small stuff.
Well, this is a small job I'm offering you.
What is it, busting into the Bank of England, eh?
No. It's a simple matter of knocking off a nice new motor.
Well, what's the dope?
Well, it's this way. The car belongs to a fellow named Lambert who lives at 14 Graysdyke Crescent. See? He can't get it into the garage beside the house on account of it being too big.
Why didn't the mug measure it before he bought it?
Well, that's not our concern. He locks the car up at night, and I've obtained a duplicate set of keys.
Oh, nice work, nice yeah. work. Yeah, what do you want me in on the job for? You can do it yourself.
Oh, there is a little complication.
Oh, I thought there would be.
This fellow Lambert is like a mother with a child over this car. He fixes it to a lamppost every night with two big padlocks and a double chain. Wonder he doesn't put a nappy on it.
Well, what do we do? Take the lamppost as well as the car?
Well, before I tell you, are you in with me?
All right, Pike, I'm in.
Then listen to what I tell you.
In the early hours of the following morning, the Pike and his assistant went along to Graysdyke Crescent, and there, sure enough, chained to the lamppost outside number 14, was a fine new motor car, its cellulose and chromium work glinting invitingly under the lamplight.
It's a special day, eh? What did I tell you? We can clean up 450 on this, and all we've got to do is to remove the back wheel, which is chained to the lamppost. We put on the spare and we're away.
Okay, Pike, let's get cracking.
The offending wheel was removed from the axle and left, still chained, to the lamppost. And by the light of the helpful rays from above, the spare wheel was bolted on, the tools were replaced in the boot, and the two men climbed into the car.
I hope that ignition key of yours works, Parker.
Of course it works. I tried it out last night.
Ah, good for you.
And here we go. I told you it was going to be easy, didn't I, Ed?
It's money for old Roper. Ah, you're a good one, you are, Pike. Just let me know when you need any more help. I'm your man.
Walter Pievsky pulled his tartan scarf snugly around his throat and agreed that he would certainly keep his assistant in mind. The car itself was taken to a garage, where its numbers and appearance were carefully changed and, in due course, found its way by devious routes back to the open market. The Pike, of course, had to split the profits which hurt him, so on his next job, he decided to work alone. And it was the next job which put him on the long, long walk which was to finish on the scaffold.
Now, what's the number of that gouge? Ah, here it is, I've got it. If this works, Buck, my lad, you're in the money. But it all depends on how good I can sound on the phone. I'll copy my father's voice, rest his soul. Here we go.
Green's Motors, good evening.
Hello? Brins?
Yes, sir. Can I help you?
My name is Maurice Bluet of 17 Granford Court.
Oh, yes, sir. I know. The big block of flats in Colliton Drive.
That's right. I'm staying here with a friend, Major General Lewis.
Oh, yes, sir.
He tells me that you have a new Rolls Coupe in your showroom.
Yes, sir. Indeed we have.
Yes, well, I'm anxious to take such a car back to the continent with me, but time is pressing.
Are you at 17 Granford Court now, sir?
Yes, if someone could bring round the car, I should like to see it.
Right, I'll be with you in a quarter of an hour, sir.
Are you sure that is not too much trouble?
Oh, no trouble at all, sir. Thank you very much for ringing.
Thank you. I should be waiting for you.
15 minutes later, the car drove up to the block of flats. The driver salesman got out and went inside. Entering the lift, he went up to the third floor and knocked on the door of number 17. Needless to say, the occupier had never heard of either Maurice Bluet or Major General Lewis. But while the questions and explanations sorted themselves out, Walter Pievsky was already driving the luxury car toward the garage where practiced hands were waiting to completely change its identity. First, what the Pike did not know was that he had provided the police with a vital clue that was to lead him first to prison and then, by reason of the tartan scarf, to the gallows. But the scarf was yet to earn its place, of course, among these strange exhibits here in the Black Museum. Elated at the success of his confident scar trick, he made a handsome profit on the rolls, and despite the fact that the police subsequently traced it, they never traced the theft back to the Pike, not until he tried the same operation again. Certainly he changed the district, but, as is so often the case with a regular criminal, he develops regular habits, and the routine served up to the local garage was almost exactly as before.
I'm staying with Sir Leslie, and he tells me you've got that straight eight in the showroom. I'm most anxious to take a car back to the continent with me, but time is pressing, and you see...
I'd be delighted to bring the car around to you right away, sir, if that's convenient.
If you're sure that it's not too much trouble.
No trouble at all, sir. I'll be with you in 10 minutes.
Oh, that is most kind. Thank you. Excellent.
But you wouldn't think it was so excellent from your point of view if you knew what was happening at the garage, Pike.
Hello? Give me the police. Is that Scotland Yard?
Yes, information room.
Listen, my name is Slater. I run a garage, Carlsbrook Street, North 1.
Yes, sir.
A few weeks ago, the local police warned me about a car thief who worked a telephone trick, asking salesmen to take cars round to fake addresses for inspection.
He just rung you, has he, Mr. Slater?
Yeah. It might be him, or it might be genuine. But he asked me to take a car round to 21, Goulston Court, Cattimar Street.
On the advice of Scotland Yard, Mr. Slater took the car to Goulston Court. To make it easier for the thief, he left the doors unlocked and went into the building. When he was safely inside, the Pike left his telephone box and walked smartly over to the waiting motor. There were just two things he didn't know. First, an ignition wire had been snipped. And second, he was being watched. She'll never start until that broken wire is mended, Pike. You're wasting your time. You're going to waste a lot more time, too. 7 years, to be exact.
Hello, sir. You're having a bit of starting trouble.
Oh, hello, officer. Yes, I don't know what's happened here.
I'm used to this sort of thing, so is the other constable here.
Oh, there's two of you.
There's a lot more at the end of the road. Suppose you hop out of that and let us see whether we can't get the car going for you.
No, I can manage.
All the same, you might let us have a go for you.
Okay.
That's the idea. Are you the owner of this car?
Hold him, George. He's got a knuckle there, sir.
Let me go, you swamp!
No, you don't. Oh, darling. Put the bracelets on him, quick. You all right, 71?
Oh, how is he?
Looks as if his jaw's broken, Inspector. Right, take this man to the station. What's his name?
I ain't talking.
Very well. I'm charging you with grievous bodily harm and resisting arrest for the attempted theft of this vehicle. There may be further charges.
There were further charges, including the theft of the big rolls. Walter Pievsky, alias the Pike, had played the same game once too often, and a search of his flat in the East End produced more evidence of his varied career in crime. The policeman waiting for him to make his first mistake. This time he'd done it. At the Old Bailey, he pleaded guilty to over 100 crimes, and there were hundreds more with which he was never charged. He was sent to prison for 7 years, and immediately on his reception, his personal belongings were entered in the property book, and he was wearing the tartan scarf which later was to hang him.
Juliet, grey, 7½, collar, 16, brown, one scarf, red background, green and blue stripes, white and yellow overcheck.
A canned steward.
How do you know that, Pievsky?
The fellow I bought it from in Petticoat Lane told me.
I'll take his word for it. Oh, there's a small tear, 5 inches from one corner. Been roughly patched. Better put that down.
Don't worry, boys. I won't accuse you of doing it.
Don't you worry. I'll be retired by then. One pair leather gloves, size 8, one pair black socks, 10, brown shoes.
The tartan scarf had been duly entered, and little did the retiring prison officer dream that his hastily scribbled details were to be subsequently brought up as key evidence in a murder trial. But Pievsky signed the list of his personal property, and for the next 7 years he was a guest of His Majesty's government in the most famous prison in England, Dartmoor. But in 1946, justice had run its course. The Pike was given back his personal property, which included the tartan scarf, of course, all duly signed for. So he was released upon a battle-scarred London. Time passed, and he added to his lawful wages by meager pickings from the black market. And more time passed, until one day the inspiration came to him like a bolt from the blue. He mulled it over in his mind. He carried out the research, and not until the plans were cut and dry did he put Ed Javison in the picture.
This is going to be the cleanup, Eddie.
Yeah, what is it, Pike?
We're going to stick up a post office van, see?
A post office van?
Shh! I've been standing in for a chap selling papers right outside a big post office in the West End. Every night I watch the mailbags coming out and going into the vans around 6 o'clock. Well, the other night I hired a car and followed one. It cut through Braston Mews to Park Lane.
Yeah, did you say you hired a car?
Yes, what about it?
Never mind. Go on.
Well, I had it out 3 nights, and I found the vans don't change their route. It's the Mews every time. Cuts off a bit of traffic, you see?
Yeah. Go on.
Now, the Mews are very dark. Badly bombed and no residents that I could see.
Yeah, I'll get it, yeah.
All we have to do is get a fast car and wait there until the last van comes through.
Yeah, how many are there?
Only two. We draw our car out in the path of the second one as if we were going to back into the Gallard, see?
Yeah.
The van stops.
Yeah.
We fix the 2 men in it. Fill up our car from the back and bring the stuff back here to sort.
To sort? Oh, I like that. Yes. Here we can bring it through the back way. When do we do it?
Well, I think our most profitable haul will be tonight, Friday.
But what about a car?
Oh, you can leave that to me.
And Walter Pievsky ran true to form. He wanted a fast car in a hurry. He applied the methods he knew. He worked the telephone trick on a young and trusting motor salesman who duly delivered a shining, high-powered limousine to a block of flats. As he disappeared into the entrance, full of expectation, the Pike drove off rapidly to Braston Mews, where his partner was waiting for him. The timing was perfect. As the car stopped, the first post office van was already approaching.
Here, keep your head down, Ed. Here it comes. The second one won't be more than a minute or so behind. We must turn the car broadside onto it.
How did you get this barrow?
I'll tell you later. It's hand-picked, see? Plenty of room in the back for the luggage. There we are. Nothing can get by now.
What happens if something tries to get through before the van arrives?
Well, we make way for it and come back another night if necessary. Here, what's this?
It's the van. We're going to be all right.
Nobody about. Couldn't be better. Now, get out.
Yeah?
Keep your chin tucked into your scarf like me.
Oh, no.
Pretend to be pushing the car.
Right.
What's up, Compton?
Oh, I'm afraid so.
Could you give us a push?
Sorry, mustn't leave the van.
Oh. Well, look, in that case, I wonder if you'd like to earn yourselves 10 bob, eh? If you could ring this number for us when you get to your own destination, it's
It's my garage.
I'd lock him and send a breakdown for you, eh?
That's the idea.
Oh, don't mind doing that for you. I'll do it for nothing.
Oh, thanks, Sam. You're very kind. Have you got a pencil? I'll jot down my name. It's rather a difficult one.
Yeah, here's a pencil. Oh, help!
Dirty thieves!
Oh, it's got the both of them.
Good. We'll start getting the bags out quick.
No, you don't.
I'll set you up, you sniveling idiot.
I'm choking. This skull's choking me.
Here, quick with the bags, Ed.
Oh, no, here they come.
What going? You'll swing for it.
Start getting the stuff in the car.
Okay.
Right. Oh, I reckon it's about as much as we can take. Here. Oh, what's happened to the driver?
Don't worry about him. Get moving.
Here. Here, look at his tongue. His eyes. You've killed him.
Stop talking. Get on with the job.
There's a car coming. They've got us in their headlights. It's the cops.
Well, let's get out of here. Hold tight on the corner.
Keep going. They're after us. Oh, watch the traffic lights. They're red. Something's coming.
Oh, I got through.
Oh, I thought we'd had it. Oh, the police car's held up by the other car.
But get away. I'm going to make it.
Put them in. Slow up. We can't get round.
Red Javison died in that crash, so mutilated that his body could not be identified. By some miracle, the pike escaped and staggered away into the shadows. But his tartan scarf was still round the throat of his victim, lying in the mews. Now let Superintendent Brandreth take up the story of the hunt.
Well, the hunt was soon over. In fact, as soon as the car was reported stolen, I had a call from one of my inspectors.
I thought you'd like to see this.
What is it, Harrison? Oh, stolen car. Well?
Well, I've checked with criminal records, sir. There was something familiar about the method. You know, calling up a garage and getting the salesman to deliver the car to a block of flats.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the list of men who practiced that. Now, these two are inside at present.
Yes.
This one's going straight. Well, he's out of London anyway.
That leaves this one, Walter Pievsky.
Yes, sir. The Pike.
Nowhere to find him?
He's sharing a place with a man named Javison in the East End.
Right. Bring him in.
Yes, sir.
But before the Pike was picked up for questioning about the car, his scarf was...
recognized as the one which we believe Pievsky had stolen. In theory, the evidence against him was already piling up. If he was the car thief, he was probably the murderer as well. But I needed that extra piece of evidence. I called for everything that was known about him, including the list of his personal property which he had signed in prison. It was a shot in the dark, but it yielded results.
There's no doubt about the scarf being his property, Superintendent, even to the patch on it.
Within 24 hours, the Pike was caught. Still dazed by the car crash, he offered no resistance. In due course, he was convicted of the murder of William Price, the driver of the post office van. And at 8 o'clock, one cold morning in February, he was hanged. All because of this tartan scarf, which has earned its place today in the Black Museum.
Now here in person is Orson Welles.
Under English law, there are no degrees of murder, and the death sentence has to be pronounced on a man or woman convicted of the crime. Recommendations to mercy by the jury are always carefully considered. But in the case of Walter H. Pievsky, no such recommendation was made. The evidence against him was unshakable, and on the eve of his execution he reproached himself bitterly, not for the death of his victim, or even his unfortunate partner, but for two other reasons. The supreme crime of murder had brought him no profit, and as his last hour approached, he became increasingly angry at his own forgetfulness. Ah, yes, they usually overlook something. And that's why the faded piece of tartan has earned its place here among the other exhibits in the Black Museum. Now, until we meet again in the same place, for another story about the Black Museum, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles, is presented by arrangement with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Radio Attractions, with original music composed and conducted by Sidney Torch, produced by Harry Allen Towers.
Well, that's about it again. So I'm going to head out the door now. But before I go, I'll give Mr. Billy Mays a spin. This is Gary Clinton, and you can write me at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. Night Transmissions, that's one word, no space between the night and the transmissions. I'd sure like to hear from you. Here is Rhapsody in Blue. Thank you.